Okay, folks, this is Elvin Shamroth here. I want to welcome you again to teleseminar. And the way we conduct this, and for those of you who are joining us for the first time today, we usually, I use the word usually because the last two sessions and today, again, we've never had this before. We don't have any volunteers. We usually get one or two volunteers to submit a case or two that they're concerned about. Perhaps there was a complication. Perhaps they weren't sure of how to present the case in the best light. And we discuss them. And it's invariably, even though it's a problem for a specific candidate, virtually always, and I make sure that this is the case, there's very relevant information in these cases, how one goes about solving the issue, that's relevant to everyone listening in. And these sessions are unprepared in the sense we don't rehearse them. It goes wherever the conversation takes us. And I also always keep total anonymity amongst those who volunteer, mentioning only the first name, never the last name. So you don't need to worry about saying something which is potentially embarrassing in front of however many colleagues are listening in. So that's the story normally, but again, today we don't have any volunteers, and folks, it sounds like a threat, and maybe it is, but if we don't start getting volunteers in future sessions, I may consider just stopping it, because it's so much more valuable when we get people to volunteer and pose the questions they've got and the specific cases that they've got. So we don't have that again today. But I do want to, nevertheless, I will do what I've done in previous cases. I'm going to open up, unmute everyone, ask you please to make sure that there's no, you're in a place where there's no background noise, because otherwise all of us are going to hear it, and it can become majorly problematic. So please make sure that you're in a place where there's no background noise. And then I'm going to unmute us all, and I would ask you just to, like we've done in the past, simply call out your first name, I'll acknowledge, and then you can talk, and everyone will hear you, and we'll discuss the concern that you have. So I'm going to open up right now, 3, 2, 1. Everyone is good. There's a lot of silence, which is great. No background noise. So look, folks, this is your time. Anyone with a question, a concern, a problem, they're not sure how to present, defend, write a case up, go ahead, shout out your first name, I'll acknowledge, and then we'll talk. So it's open to you, folks. Please, if someone will just shout out their first name, and we'll take it from there.
Hi, Dr. Shamroth. This is Melody.
Melody, hi. Thank you so much for volunteering. I really appreciate it. Go ahead and share with us your concern.
Thank you.
Just by the way, I'm going to try with this session to, you may have heard me mention this before, I'm going to talk a little bit about, or try and teach you folks a little bit about reverse engineering your cases, so that you write them up in such a way that you can get the examiner to ask you the questions you want. And it works beautifully, by the way. To do the thing full justice would take an hour or two, an hour and a half or so. So we're just going to hit the tip of the iceberg here, but it's still very valuable. That being said, Melody, go ahead and share with us your concern.
Thank you. So I'll preface my question by saying that I work as a laborist, and I have many patients that I start inductions on. work them up, start their induction, and see them through, and then their primary attending or the attending to follow my shift will pick up and deliver them. So how do I categorize them, or should I say place them on my list, even though I was not the delivering physician? And the second part to being of that question is sometimes I'll start them or see them in triage, send them home, and they come back for delivery with another provider. So kind of a two-part question.
Okay, let's take the first one first. First of all, your question is seemingly a simple, straightforward question, but there's a lot behind it. Number one, if you did not do the delivery, strictly speaking, she's not on your list. Alternatively, if you never saw a patient at all, but came in at 8 o'clock in the morning, she was fully dilated, you delivered her, and there was, some kind of complication, you need to put her on your list. The major criteria for when to include an OB patient that you saw on your list is based on, did you do the delivery? So that's the short answer. But there's a lot more to this, because if it may be, Melody, I'm not sure. But let me ask you, do you do any deliveries of non-private patients that are perhaps, you know, hospital patients? Do you do deliveries by design in the way your contract is structured with the hospital?
I do, but the majority of the patients seen, it's more so private patients than the no docs or the staff patients.
Okay.
So just to get
a sense of the issue. And again, folks, a small but significant number of you will have the same kind of situation or variations of the situation that Melody is describing. And I encourage you all to go through this process. Melody, when all is said and done, how many deliveries do you put on average per month? I'm trying to see how much of an issue this is for you. So what would you say is your average number of deliveries that you do per month?
Me personally, I can't put a number, maybe 10, 5 to 10.
Okay, so if you're doing 5 to 10, let's say 7, you're on average doing about 80, 90 deliveries yourself a year. So it's not like you're short on cases, that you're not going to have the minimum number required in order to submit your case list. You've got plenty of cases. So in that situation, I will recommend, unless you want to put the patient on for some reason or other, which we'll talk about in a moment, strictly speaking, you didn't do the delivery, she doesn't appear on your list. Now, what happens if you didn't do the delivery, but you may have seen this patient in the clinic, or let's say she had an antepartum bleed, third trimester bleed, you worked up and found her to have a significant abruption, let's say, or some bleeding diathesis. And there's a wonderful discussion to be had in the exam on the diagnosis, workup, and management of third trimester bleeding and bleeding disorders. Okay? So if this case was one of those kind of cases where there's some interesting stuff, which you, by the time the exam came along, will you either know already or will be ready to talk about that topic. Then this becomes a subject, this becomes a patient that even though she shouldn't, strictly speaking, appear on your case list, she's a great case to put on your case list. And in that situation, I would actually encourage you to put the case on your list with one caveat, okay? And that is, if you're relying on that case. Now, Melody, what I'm just going to describe now is not your situation, but it's for others listening in that I'm saying this. If Melody has 80, 90 cases on her overview list, or will have, if you only have 18 or 19 cases on your OB list, and you're relying on this patient to count as your 20th case, which is the minimum number required, strictly speaking, this case is not your case. So if they were to audit you, and don't get too panicked about auditing, but if they were to check out on your cases, which they apparently do in 10% of cases, just to make sure that what you say you did, and what you didn't do, you didn't leave out any that you didn't do. But they would... If you're going to rely on this case to count as one of the 20, strictly speaking, it doesn't. So they will not count it, and then you'll be left with only 18 or 19 cases on your OB list, and that's insufficient for, it's not admissible to take the exam, and you cause problems for yourself. So I no problem with you adding a case that, strictly speaking, should not be there, provided it's not essential to include that in your tally of a minimum of 20 cases. You should have 20 cases excluding that case. Does that make sense to you, Melody, even though I know that's not your situation? But does it make sense what I just said?
Yes, thank you. So okay. You're saying that it has to be – I have to be involved in the delivery for
yes.
those cases to be
yeah.
counted.
And I encourage you to look this up in the current ABOG bulletin, on the exam bulletin for the certifying exam, and you'll see it there. Now, I want to just add another caveat, because one has to be very careful here. You'll notice that I said, I don't mind you putting on a case that, strictly speaking, shouldn't be on the list. And I don't mind that at all. I have, on the contrary, a major problem with you leaving a case off your list that should be there, because that is potentially problematic. And I know one case where the candidate got into really hot water inadvertently. You're wondering how did this happen? I'll just tell you very briefly. This was a candidate who came to our course about 15 years ago. Delightful young woman. She knew her stuff. Brilliant, pleasant, great candidate. She takes her exam and she passes. She celebrates, and in, I think it was February of the subsequent year, she got a letter from ABOG that said, we understand that there was, I don't know, three or four cases that you delivered, but you did not include them on your case list. As a consequence, this is the kicker, please reconstruct your case list. We're withdrawing the FACOG from you, and you have to come down to Dallas to take the exam again in April, whenever it was. Now, this is a nightmare situation, what there was no malevolence involved, but what had happened was she innocently didn't realize that if you did the delivery, even if you only saw her 10 minutes before she delivered, and you delivered her and never saw her again, if this was not a normal pregnancy or delivery or postpartum period, she must be included on your list. And she had about 3 or 4 such patients where this happened, but she didn't include them because she saw them just for the delivery, which spanned, let's say, 20 minutes and never saw them again. Unfortunately for her, one of the patients turned out to subsequently develop, if I remember correctly, it's not relevant, but I think she had a postpartum hemorrhage and died. There was a maternal death amongst one of those 3 or 4 patients that she didn't put on her list. And ABOG got wind of this. And to ABOG, it looked like she was trying to hide maternal death, which you can understand from ABOG's perspective. They would regard that as problematic. And so they asked her to basically come and sit the exam again. You don't want that to happen to you. And so, please, why I'm sharing this all with you is to sum it up in the following sentence. I don't mind if you give ABOG extra cases, if you give them more than they're asking for, but don't give them less. This woman, this candidate that I just referred to you, shared with you, she left off of her list 3 or 4 patients, and it got her into big hot water. Now, you might ask, how did ABOG get wind of this? The story gets even worse. She had given her case list to her partner to review for her. The partner commented on what was there, and he knew that she had this maternal death, and it wasn't on her case list. They subsequently had a falling out in the practice. She left the practice, and he reported her to ABOG, which is a disgusting thing to do, in my view. But this is how ABOG got to find out about it. They investigated, and then they found out that this, in fact, was the case, and this is what was the outcome. You've got to take your exam again. So please, 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 don't make that mistake. Give them more, but don't give them less than they ask for. Okay? So, Melody, does that I've been very long-winded, but does that answer your question?
Yes, it actually answers both of my questions. Thank you so much.
All right, good, good, good. There's one other thing I wanted to mention with respect to induction. Folks, you've probably heard me say this many times before already. You need to push conservatism as much as possible, okay? And I'm talking here mostly for OB and GYN, okay? But also in the office, don't do an unnecessary test. Don't bring her back for 3 visits when she can be seen in 2. If you need to be conservative across the board, but especially in OB and GYN. Now, with that philosophy in mind, I encourage all of you to be briefly familiar with what your C-section rate is and what your induction rate is. Because oftentimes, if you have a high C-section rate, and we can have a separate conversation on what constitutes a high C-section rate, but if you have a high C-section rate, it may well be that you've got a relatively high induction rate, because at the end of the day, if you do a lot of inductions, let's say 15 or 20% of them fail, that's going to add to your C-section rate. So oftentimes they're connected. And so you, every single one of you need to go into the exam knowing what your C-section rate is, what your induction rate is. And for those of you that have borderline or high induction rates, I encourage you to go one step further. Do it now in preparation for your exam. Work out, okay, I did three inductions for hypertension. I did two inductions for uncontrolled diabetes. I did one induction for abruption. I did three inductions for X, one induction for Y, and try and make sure that every single induction had a legitimate medical or OB indication. Now, there will still be some inductions which are what I call social inductions. I don't mean this in a negative way. It was a Thursday, and you wanted to get this patient delivered before the weekend. That also is a social induction, but that has a negative connotation. I'm talking about social inductions when the patient lived very far from the hospital, didn't have readily available means of transport. There was an impending snowstorm. That's an impending hurricane. These are legitimate reasons to bring the patient in and induce. So you may have to use some of those examples, indications for some of your inductions. You want that to be as little as possible, but those still are legitimate indications. And then you get the induction at 39 weeks, which is legitimate. But the point that I'm getting, you want to make sure you've got an unquestionable standard of care indication for your induction and minimize the amount of social inductions that you've got. Make sure any induction below 39 weeks, there's a very clear-cut indication. So the discussion on induction is actually a lot bigger than what I'm sharing with you now. I'll just share with you that, and I've mentioned this before, I know virtually every single one of you listening in is ultimately going to come to our Definitive Board Prep course. But at that course, we're going to spend about half an hour, 40 minutes or so, discussing this very issue. That's how important it is. How to defend a moderate or significantly high induction rate. It's something every single one of you have to be prepared to talk about and speak to. So Melody, have we covered you on this issue? You're comfortable? You're okay with this?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Sure, no problem. All right. I still want to try and get an example of reverse engineering. So we weren't able to use it on that case of Melody's, but I'm going to throw it out to all of you folks again. Can I have someone just shout out the first name? I'll acknowledge it, and then we can have that conversation. So anyone, do you want to shout out your first name, please?
Hi, this is Christina.
Christina, hi. Thank you so much for volunteering. I appreciate it. Go ahead. Share with us your question, your concern.
Okay, so first I just want to echo Melanie's question, is that I also work in a group practice that someone may start an induction, and I do. I understand
yes.
that if we do the delivery, it must be reported. So,
yes, if it's a complicated delivery, and there are criteria what constitutes in that bulletin
right.
what constitutes
yeah.
a complication,
correct.
Yeah.
Right. No, I mean, my patient population, there has not been one that I can't not include, essentially. So
okay, okay.
But if it was started by a partner, we have to list it if we deliver it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, because you did the delivery. And
okay.
and an induction, by the way, constitutes a complicated delivery / pregnancy. So, yes, if you did the delivery that was started by your partner,
mm-hmm.
you've got to put it in if you did the delivery.
Right.
Now,
okay, so
Christina, let me take your question one step further, and maybe this is the question you're going to pose, but even if it's not, I want to just share this with everyone. What happens if your partner, your associate, does an induction, you land up doing the delivery, and now you've got the patient on your case list, and you don't necessarily agree with the indication for the induction. How do you handle that situation? Is that your question by any chance, Christina, or no?
It wasn't, but it's a great question to answer, so... Go ahead.
Okay. So let me answer, and we'll come back to your question. And this situation can happen in a multitude of medical scenarios, but it classically happens in the scenario of induction and also elective C-section. And with respect to the elective C-section, you may not agree fully with the C-section, but it's not simply, as long as she's been counseled appropriately, as long as there's an indication, and as long as it's done at the right time. But what happens if the indication for the C-section is not standard of care, or it's done prematurely, you're in the same situation? How do you handle that on your case list and in the exam? What you do on paper, you write in the antepartum or delivery column, you would say induction of labor, in parenthesis, by partner, by associate. And then you put SVD or whatever, the C-section, whatever it is, in parenthesis, by candidate. So you make it very clear you were not part of the decision to induce, but you were involved in the delivery. And then verbally, if they ask you about this case, in the exam, you verbally, politely, professionally disagree with your partner or your associate. You can say, you know, my associate was presented with this patient who requested an induction, and he set her up for induction at 38 and 4 days. I'm of the opinion it's fair to do a C-section by request if you believe this. But the patient has to be at least 39 weeks. But this patient was set up. I felt it was unfair to send her back home again. I did do a pelvic exam, and the Bishop score was 8, so I felt it was reasonable. But I must be honest, I don't think the indication was fully solid. You say that in the exam. Politely, you say, you know, this colleague of mine, he or she's actually a very good OBGYN, but in this particular case, I disagree with the decision that was made. Does that answer the secondary question that you were thinking of, Christina? Do you understand how to handle that situation?
Yeah, that does make sense. Now, if you agreed with the exception, would you still put induction started by partner, or do you just let it be?
So you can go either way with this. The question comes down to, you've got a choice in this situation. Do you prefer to own the decision for the induction or not? As a general rule, always encourage candidates to be totally open and honest. So for that reason, I would still say induction, in parenthesis, by colleague, and then delivery, whatever it was, by candidates. And then in your verbal presentation of the case, you say, you know, this decision to do an induction was actually made by my colleague, but I actually agree totally with the indication for the following reasons. But I don't agree. And you see, what you're doing is, you should not have to defend someone else's decision regarding management. So in cases like this, instead of defending the decision, rather critique the decision and say, I agree with my colleague who did this. It's a reasonable, it's one of the, here's the list of indications. I think it's a fair, reasonable indication. Or, you know, my colleague is really great. I've got a lot of respect for him, but in this particular case, I think the indication for the induction was weak. These are my indications. I think this was really acceptable for the following reason. So you're being open and honest, which is what the approach that I always try to push. So does that answer your question, Christina?
Yes, but I do have an original question on how to defend or reverse defend a case.
So what? Let's go back to your original question now. What is the question that you had in mind?
My question I had on mind is how you recommend phrasing a failed operative delivery that goes for a section. Do you recommend saying failed, and how do you go about that?
Oh, okay, fine. So a failed operative delivery is a fantastic discussion to have in the exam. It sets the stage to give you, the candidate, the opportunity to really shine in the exam. So this is, I mean, there's so much more to this, but this is part of reverse engineering. So let me pick up on this. If you just say C-section and don't mention failed forceps, for example, or failed vacuum, the chances of them asking you about failed vacuum or failed forceps are very small. But if you write on the case list, failed vacuum, not only do you write failed vacuum, but you write it in capital letters. And if the software will allow, you put it in bold to make sure that the examiner sees it when he or she briefly peruses through your case list. Put yourself in the examiner's position. Christina, you're the examiner. You see a candidate's case in front of you, and because it's in bold and capital letters, it catches your eye, and you see failed vacuum delivery. And I would go so far as to put an exclamation or two or three at the end of that to really emphasize that this was something unusual. If you, and I'm putting the question to you, Christina, right now, you're the examiner, you see a candidate who's written on their case list, failed vacuum with three exclamation marks, you're the examiner, what are you going to ask the candidate?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely ask them about that scenario in particular, and what happened during the case, and what made it a failed vacuum, et et cetera.
Exactly right. Exactly right. You're 100% correct on all of this. But my question to you now is, you're back in the candidate mold. Would you, as a candidate, like to face those questions that you just mentioned when you were acting as the role of examiner? Would you like to have that conversation? Is that a conversation that you'd be able to show you understand the issues at hand, you'd be able to impress your examiner, and you would do well on? What would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be prepared for any vacuum question, failed vacuum.
Yes,
questions.
Exactly right. So what I'm suggesting is, if you've got a case like this, write it up and emphasize the issue, because by emphasizing it, the examiner is that much more prone to see it. Once they see it, it's virtually impossible for them to ignore it. And once they can't ignore it, they're going to ask you questions. And what are the questions going to be? The very ones that you've said. So you can get the examiner to ask you the questions that you want just by adding in the words failed vacuum, which you don't have to do. At the end of the day, this patient was delivered by C-section. You don't have to. I'm giving you an extreme case, but it's absolutely legitimate. But I would put it in. I'd put it in bold. I'd put the exclamation marks at the end. And once the examiner sees that, you've got your series of questions, and the next 2-3 minutes of your exam, you're scoring hypothetically at 100%. So this is what I call reverse engineering. Rather than just writing up your case list like an automaton without putting any thought into it and just hoping that whatever questions the examiner asks you, you're able to handle in the exam, rather than do that, put a lot of energy into your case list right now and write it up in such a way that it virtually obligates the examiner to ask you a question on that particular issue. And that you'll only do it if the questions that have become obligated are questions that you're going to be comfortable to handle. I may have mentioned this previously, but let me share a completely different example. Let's say you would love to have a conversation on ICE immunization, okay? And if the incidence of Rh negative status is, let's say, 10-15%, so the average person on a case will have at least one patient who's Rh negative. So if you want to have that ICE immunization conversation, what I would encourage you to do is in the antepartum column, write Rh negative, antepartum complication, Rh negative. In the treatment or post or treatment column, delivery can be any of those, write Rogam not given. Okay? If the examiner sees Rh negative, Rogam not given, they have to ask you, why didn't you give Rogam? And then you turn around and say, well, I would have, these are my indications, but in this particular case, the father of the baby was Rh negative as well, so it wasn't indicated. But that's, now you've got the conversation rolling on ICE immunization. And they'll probably say, well, what would you have done had the father not have been Rh negative? And then you get your ICE immunization conversation going. So, again, it's your choice how you want to write up the case. If you, again, this is reverse engineering. If you start off, rather than just writing it down and hoping that you can answer whatever questions they ask you, you decide, okay, on this case, we're going to do it the exact opposite. On this case, I want to try and get an ICE immunization conversation going. How am I going to write it up to entice the examiner to get this conversation going. And the way you do it, Rh negative, rogue and not given, with an exclamation mark. Does that make sense to you, Christina? Do you realize how you're almost obligating the examiner to ask you why didn't she get Rogam?
Yeah, no, that is perfectly clear. I think the only part that wasn't clear to me is you mentioned, like, oh, you don't have to write failed vacuum. Isn't that technically a complication of delivery and
I did say it's a little extreme. I would, if there's no one listening in to this teleconference who would be uncomfortable to handle a conversation on vacuum. In fact, a conversation on vacuum is a great conversation to have, an easy conversation to have in the exam. But hypothetically, if you were a person who really was very uncomfortable with assisted vaginal delivery, and for whatever reason you wanted to avoid going down that road, then using the principles of reverse engineering, do your utmost not to mention anything that would precipitate a conversation on that subject. So you can leave it off, and if the examiner happens to ask you that case, first of all, if it's just a simple induction which failed, and C-section, which is the way you write it up on paper, the chance of the examiner stopping on that case and asking you anything is pretty small. But if they did, then I would never tell you to lie in the exam. You can then verbally say, well, this patient had an induction. We got it to 10 centimeters. I attempted a vacuum, but for the following reasons, it didn't work, and I was forced to land up doing a C-section. But the indication for the – you try and get the conversation back to the induction. But the indication for the induction was correct. It was A, B, C, D, E. And try and steer, and this is the oral exam technique issue we're talking about now, try and steer the conversation away from failed vacuum and towards induction. And there are ways to do that, okay? Now, you're never going to hear me tell you to lie in the exam. I wouldn't do that. There are gray zones from time to time, and you can, you know, push a gray zone to a certain extent. But there's a lot of information which I call non-essential information. What is essential information? Age, parity, gestational age, etc., mode of delivery, number of days in hospital. You have to give that. But a lot of the rest is what I call non-essential. Rh negative. No one says you have to mention Rh negative as a complication. I think it's great to do so, but you don't have to. I'm calling it non-essential information. And in an extreme case, a failed vacuum is non-essential, but I'm trying to strike a balance with all of you listening in. It's the hesitation that Christina expressed is justified. We generally would want to say, and we generally would put it down on paper. But I'm just giving you a scenario. If, for example, hypothetically, you really wanted to avoid a conversation on this, write it down as blandly as possible, not to increase the likelihood of that particular case coming up under discussion. And then you don't have to deal with the issue at all. But if you do get asked on that case, then you've got to mention it. I would never recommend that you should be dishonest. But it's your choice to decide whether or not to mention it or not. And there are a thousand different ways to skin a cat, okay? And you can choose to put down, look, induction, failed induction, C-section is not wrong. It's not dishonest. There's some context that's missing. But if they don't ask for the context, then you're good to go. If they ask for the context, then you give it, and then you do the best you can. Does that answer your question, Christina?
That was extremely helpful. Thank you so much.
All right, great. Folks, listen, I like to keep this at about 45 minutes, and we're pretty much out of time. I only scratched the surface barely regarding reverse engineering. It's really an important part of constructing your case list. I will get my plug in for those of you that haven't yet attended our cases construction course. It's a one-day course. You can watch it online from your home. We go into much more detail regarding reverse engineering. And I'm just telling you, we know historically that virtually every one of you will attend that course. I just want to emphasize this much. If you're planning on attending that course, attend it as soon as possible, because the sooner you expose yourself to that course, the sooner you will change the way you collect cases, and you've got some degrees of freedom in which cases you choose for office. You'll change the way you select cases. You certainly will change the way you put down cases, and it'll make a huge difference for you in the exam itself. So I encourage you. I know you folks are pretty much every one of you are going to come to the course, but come as soon as you can, because it'll have an impact on what you do right away, and the sooner the better. All righty. So Melody and Christina, to the two of you, thank you so much for volunteering. Those were good questions, good issues, and I hope you found it helpful. Again, folks, I implore you, please, I want to have this every 2 weeks. It's really worthwhile and can be very beneficial, but it's a lot more beneficial if someone volunteers and we don't have to do it the way I've done it the last three sessions. So please, we're looking for volunteers. The week before the next session, send in a case. Just send it into info@examprol.com. You want to volunteer a case for a teleseminar, and my office staff will pass that email on to me, and we'll discuss it. And we can discuss it in great depth. And like I said, it's really, really worthwhile. I encourage all of you to do it. So we didn't get it this time, but Melody and Christina saved the day for us. So thank you to the two of you. Melody, did you find the session helpful? Did you find it worthwhile volunteering the way you did?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Good, good. And Christina, how about you?
100%. Thank you.
Okay. And I always ask, for the rest of you listening in, listen to what they're saying. It's really beneficial. It's really helpful. And I want to encourage all you folks to do it. All right, folks, that's it. We'll do this again in 2 weeks' time, hopefully. But please, volunteer, send in cases. It makes it a lot more interesting. Christina, Melody, thank you so much. To the rest of you listening, thank you very much. And we'll see you all again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you, and this thing concludes our teleconference. Thank you. Bye-bye.